If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Before we get started, we want to tell you a bit about the sponsor of this week's History Extra podcast, Warner Hotels. If you're looking to escape to a picturesque corner of the UK for a few days, Warner Hotels has just the thing for you. Each hotel offers everything you could possibly need for the perfect weekend away. From unrivaled leisure facilities and inspiring live entertainment to delicious dining experiences and plenty of history for you to uncover. If this sounds like your kind of getaway, Warner Hotels is now offering a series of exciting weekend packages in 2024. Each three-night stay is at one of three historic hotels, with dinner, bed and breakfast included, plus a whole itinerary of fascinating talks and Q&As with a selection of BBC history experts, such as Tracy Borman, Susanna Lipscomb and James Holland. So what are you waiting for? Book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. What was it really like to live and fight in a First World War trench? Why was throwing your empty food cans into no man's land a death sentence? And what was the worst care package a Tommy could receive from home? Speaking with Emily Briffitt, historian Peter Hart answers your top questions on life in the front line during the First World War in the latest in our Everything You Wanted to Know series.
Hi, Peter. It's an absolute pleasure to be chatting to you today.
Hello, Emily. Nice to be here.
Can you describe the trenches to us? Just from the outset, what were they like?
It's one of those questions that sound very easy, but are quite difficult in the sense that they change throughout. But if I could describe a classic British trench, it would be about 6 foot deep, about 3 foot six wide. It would have a fire step about 18 inches tall and about 18 inches across. That's where people could stand so they could shoot at the Germans, which is a bit rough, but there you go. And in front of the trench, there would be a parapet, which would be 3 foot tall from the flat earth and about 6 foot deep, because, you know, bullets go through things much more than you think. And then behind, there's a parados, which is the same. So that would be the fundamental trench. They might have an A-frame. They should have wood or chicken wire sort of stuff as reveting to stop them falling in. Because I remember when I was young, they used to always have people getting into workman trenches and they'd collapse and they'd be killed. And my father always used to warn me. And of course, that's what happens if you have a trench. You have to revet it. And so that's what they did. That's a trench of a sort. Now, some of them are just ditches. Some of them are sort of concreted. Some of them are, you know, there's a world of difference going on. But that's, in its simplest terms, a frontline trench.
So one of our first questions, big contextual question from Neil Eads on Facebook is, how far did the trenches stretch? Where exactly were they?
Well, they went from the North Sea right the way down to Switzerland. It's 475 miles, which is a long way if you think about, just think about it. And what I really want you to think about is there isn't just one front line. There's also the communication trenches that stretch back. Then there's the support lines, which is just the same as the front lines. And then behind that is the reserve lines. So if you just times it by three, that's 1,500. But then you have all the other trenches. And sometimes there's more than one system. So there are thousands and thousands of miles of these 6 foot deep trenches. Just think what that means. Some poor sod has to dig them.
And okay, here's another one then. Nicholas Sergis on Twitter has asked, what was trench warfare like on the Eastern Front? Was it different from the Western Front?
In some ways, yes. It's just bigger. It's the Austro-Hungarian army, the German army and the Russian army just bashing into each other for 3 or 4 years of murderous fighting. The trenches are similar, of course. It depends on where you are. So if it's marshy and there were great marshy patches, then they would be breastworks. They weren't as sophisticated. They weren't as, you know, but the fighting was absolutely murderous. And the casualties dwarf, in many cases, what happened on the Western Front. If you want to know the length, they stretch from the Baltic to, by the end of the war, the Black Sea, and they range, it depends which way they went, because they move a lot, between 800 miles and 1,500 miles. So you can see this is a big scale thing. One thing to remember about the Eastern Front is it's continental Europe. It's cold. So when it comes to wintertime, we think we're suffering on the Western Front. It's much colder, you know, with those Siberian winds rushing across and all the rest of it. So that's what it was like. It is just as bad as the Western Front. We often forget the Eastern Front, but actually you've got to remember it. It's just we're a bit British-centric about things.
So this leads me on to my next question that we've had from someone on Instagram. Were any trenches known to be particularly bad to serve in? They've asked, is it true that British trenches were worse to live in than German ones?
Well, again, I'm going to have to give a struggle with asking historians things, is they tend to go, well, one land, it depends where and when. As a general point, the German trenches are better sited because they were falling back. They picked where they were. So they will pick a ridge line, they'll have the forward posts on the front, there are nice trenches on the rear out of sight, and their reserve lines behind that. And so they will be drier, they'll be better sighted. The British and French lines tend to be where they got to in advancing up to it, and they tended to be where they were stopped. So they're not as well sighted. Sometimes they'd fall back, sometimes they'd sap forward, dig forward and try and get closer. That's basically what it was like. So yes, they were, but I have to say the Germans, as they were in defence, they often had time to put more wood in. They'd have lots of revetting. Their dugouts were better. They'd bring up more home comforts because they were intending to be there for a long time. Whereas British trenches and French trenches had a more temporary feel because we were always going to go on the big push. We were going to advance to victory any time now. The fact it took 3 or 4 years is a separate matter. But that sort of explains a bit of that.
So now I'd like to talk a little bit about who might we have met if we were to go back in time and go into the trenches. So exactly that, who was stationed in the trenches?
Well, everybody at some time or another, if you were in the army and male, female personnel obviously weren't in the trenches. The way they did it, that the British in particular had a fantastic system whereby a battalion was about 1,000 men. There are 3 or later 4 battalions in a brigade. There are 3 brigades in a division. There are 4 brigades to call. And they circulated them all around like a gigantic jigsaw puzzle, constantly going round and round. So if you'd all be in the trenches at some time, but in any given week or month, you wouldn't be in for long. And they tried to make it so the maximum time you're in the front line was 2 or 3 days. And then you'd go back to the support line, back to the reserve lines, then out to rest. And you'd be unlucky if you spent more than 10 days in the line in the whole month. People think people went and lived in the trenches and stayed there for 3 years. They didn't. They were constantly circulating around. And the idea of it was to preserve morale. The idea was so that you'd think, ha, ha, I can go and see that girl in Amiens, or I can go and have that pint wine or something at the Estaminet. It's basically human nature gives you something to look forward to. This trench is murder, but in 2 days or 2 nights, I'll be out. You might not be, because you might be dead, but at least you've got hope. Now, the Germans and French weren't quite so organised on this, or certainly not in the early stages, and they tended to stay in the line a lot longer, and it does affect morale. So basically everybody was in the trenches, was in the army and in a fighting unit. Well, it's a good question in a sense because, of course, the army's like a triangle and the fighting battalions are there. But behind them, they have the Army Service Corps who provided their food and moved everything up. They've got all the people working the railways. They've got all the people in the camps. They've got everybody. They've got the artillery. They've got loads of people who are not in the front line, but they're all vital, absolutely vital to what happens in the front.
I think you've also answered there. We've had quite a few questions about people asking how long and how often were troops on the front line. So Kristen Finch on Facebook, Denise Fairbrother on Facebook as well, Guy Bailey on Twitter. Lots of people asking that question, so that's perfect.
Well, it's good that they asked because it's obvious that they've been thinking about it. And that's, to me, that's important that the people engage with history and think, hang on a minute, did they really stay in the front? How long did they stay? Hey, Pete, how long did they stay in the front line? And I see why people ask. And when you find out the answer, it's obvious why it's that length of time, that short length. It is to keep people going. So that's a good question.
So this is a similar one we've had from Susan Politz on Twitter. She's asked, did soldiers stationed in the trenches also serve elsewhere, or were they likely to have spent most of their time based around the trenches?
It depends where you are. If you're on the Western Front, then you'd spend a lot of time training. So they pull you out of the line and you'd be out of the line for 2-3 weeks and there's new weapons to learn. But you have to learn how to use these new weapons. New tactics are coming through all the time. Contrary to what people think, the Great War is a really innovative period for tactics and things. They've got to be rebuilt. They've got to get new drafts in from home and rebuild. So if you've had 300 casualties, which is about normally, say, 70 killed and the rest wounded, then all of them have gone. So you've got to replace them, but they have to be built into the system, new officers, new NCOs. So they're a lot of the time out of the line, they're working on that. The other thing they're doing is working parties, which are, they go forward to do all the dirty jobs. And they moaned like hell about it. Of course they did. So you come out of the line to rest and you think, oh, then you've got to train. Oh. And then when you finish moaning about training, you're sent on a working party carrying up, for instance, how does that wood that rivets the trench get to the front? Somebody has to carry it. How does the water, how does everything get forward? The ammunition, the munitions, they've all got to be carried. And so they've all got to get on with that. So that's another thing that they're up to. Don't think when you're out of the line, you're not busy, because you are busy. It's just you're not actually fighting the Germans face to face.
On the note of training, Vincent Hannon on Twitter has asked about any training to live in the type of conditions, say, that the trenches posed?
I mean, Vincent's asked a good question because, yes, people are trained much more. Back home, they have, in fact, there's archaeologists finding them all over the country. If you go to a local park, in fact, at Clitterhouse Fields, you can see the marks on the ground of trenches, practice trenches that were dug to practice going over the top, to practice brief periods of living in them. They didn't so much live in them, because I'll come back to that. But what they did is practice attacking from the, practice the shape of them, practice that sort of. And those things are in the parks. They're in, if you live in London, you can see they were in Hyde Park, all the big parks, Regent's Park, there were trenches that were practice trenches and used by the soldiers. The real way they get used to it is when they come to the Western Front, they have a period of often a month or so where they would be attached to units that are already there. And if you think about it, that's how it works. So they'd go in as a sort of platoon or company at a time and be attached to a regiment in the line who would show them what it was like, explain to them, don't put your head up there, you know, just how to live your life in the line. And then gradually the whole battalion of 1,000 men would go through this process. And then when they've gone through the process, then they're ready to be put in the line. And the first time they're in the line, it'll be a quiet sector. So again, there's time. The British Army is not stupid. That this is the myth. So they're introduced to it as best they can. But that is, again, I like that question because it shows people are thinking about what's going on.
Another big question we've had is about the Empire troops. So could you tell us a little bit about their role on the front line?
Well, I think their role in the whole war is absolutely crucial. And you've got to realise how important it is. Can I start with the biggest contribution, which was the Indian army, which includes what we now call India, Bangladesh, Pakistan. But it was a huge army measured by millions. They actually arrived, a whole corps arrived on the Western Front. And of course, a lot, two divisions, 30, 40, 50,000 men. And they arrived just in time in about October 1914. And actually, they probably saved the day. I'm not saying without them we'd have lost the war. But for the British Army, they were absolutely crucial. They proved to be good fighting men. So there's no looking down on them. Some people attempt to, but they're being silly. They didn't like the weather. But can I just... You know, people sometimes say, oh, the Indian Corps, it got cold because it was winter. It was an appalling winter. And the British troops got cold as well. And they moaned. Oh, sorry, they observed. Troops never moan, they only observe. And the Indian contribution was immense. And then later on, they were sent, most of them, not the cavalry, most of them were sent away to serve in Palestine and in Mesopotamia. And there they are, they're the backbone of the force. And both of those campaigns are ultimately successful. So you can't deny the importance of the Indian Army within the British Army. And then if you're talking about Empire troops, I think we ought to talk about the Australians and New Zealanders. And they are acknowledged as, if not elite formations, and they were certainly regarded as that by themselves, most of all, but also by everybody else, i.e. the British, the Germans, you know, everybody who just takes an interest. They took a while to learn, but by the time you get to 1917, 1918, the Anzacs are a brilliant, that is an Australian New Zealand Army Corps, which later became the New Zealand Division and the Australian Corps. They're brilliant, and they are treated as an elite, as a cutting edge, and they are actually reserved by Field Marshal Haig as an elite force to strike back when they could. So they do brilliantly, and the other ones are the Canadians, who the Canadian Corps is brilliant. They are absolutely brilliant, and they are alongside the Australians, New Zealanders, and the best of the British divisions as the sort of elite forces. They really are good. They're really good. They're well led. They've got good generals, and they're fabulous. And so all together, the Empire troops, and there are many other countries make small contributions, but I don't want to get into a list. And also my memory will fail me. They make a fantastic contribution on the Western Front and everywhere else in the war. They are super important.
Time for another quick chat about this week's sponsor, Warner Hotels. If you want to get away in 2024, why not book a weekend package at one of Warner's most historic hotels? There's Littlecote House, which is a stunning Tudor manor in Hungerford, Studley Castle, a beautiful 19th century building in Warwickshire, or Home Lacey, a huge Herefordshire mansion that was once visited by Charles I. Whichever location you choose, you'll be able to enjoy a whole weekend of live talks from your favourite historians during your stay. Find out more and book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What was that experience of the war like? Was this different at all from British troops? And did it vary on where in the empire they were from or where they were actually fighting?
It varies where they're fighting as to whether it's hot or cold. And the different, I mean, places like Gallipoli, Mesopotamia, which I hadn't mentioned where the Anzacs were, and Mesopotamia and Palestine, they're riddled with dysentery. The dysentery is just everywhere, and it's awful. And other paratyphoid, other diseases, they have a very rough time. They've got lots to think about there, never mind the Turks, who are their main enemy in those fronts. On the Western Front, they have pretty well the same service conditions. There are minor differences differences in diet that the Indian troops get while they're there. But they are cultural differences in diet, which are accommodated in some part, not always entirely. They talk a lot about mateship within, and I think this is partly because they're still dominions, they're still part of the British Empire, but the writing's on the wall. They're going to be independent nations, and there's a pride, rightly so, a pride in their achievements. There's a feeling of comradeship and mateship. They just got a tremendous pride in their country and what they've achieved. And when people say, "Oh, the Canadians are different; they're more manly than the British soldier," and sort of 60% of them are British born. And that it's worth it. And the same with the Australians. Of the first lot who go to Gallipoli, I think 27%, not only were British born, but they were adults when they came to Australia. So unless they sort of grew 6 inches and became much more muscular the moment they stepped off the ship, they're just the same. People often wonder, are they treated differently? Are the Canadians treated differently from the Indians? Are the Australians treated? Are the New Zealanders treated differently? And the answer to that is they're treated differently by each other. Because the one thing to remember about soldiers is it's not just people from different countries that they look down on and in askance at. For instance, they'll always accuse the French or the British or the Canadians of not having clean trenches, clean latrines. Doesn't matter. But it's not just that. I mean, for instance, the British will accuse Northerners or Scots or people from South Londoners. It's basically part of that competition that's endemic in the British Army. Is there more active and an unpleasant, what I would define as racism? Well, the answer to that in those days is probably yes. Some of it's unconscious, some of it's deliberate. The shocking example is the treatment of the Chinese labour force, which is outrageous. But I am not the one to ask about that because I've never studied it. But I am aware that we did not treat them very well and treated them in a, there's no two ways about it, in a racist and appalling manner.
Right. Now, to go back into the experience of life in the trenches, did they take shifts?
When they're on the front line, so if they're in during the 2 or 3 days, the day has a pattern, and each man will be given various jobs at various times. For instance, they're all up at dawn, usually, well, daybreak, where they have what's called stand two. Now, stand two, guess what? They all stand two with their weapons to hand, not it's over there, sir, to hand, and they'll be inspected, make sure they've got ammunition, they're ready. Because early in the war, that's when people attacked at dawn. Later on, they attack any time they like. But stand to. Then after that, they have different duties that spends their day. They're all in the frontline area, but they've got duties. So there'll be sentries. Now, sentries, they use periscopes. So sometimes they just peer over the top. So they're there throughout the day and throughout the night. And then there are lots of people on carrying parties going back at night, for instance. They go back to get the rations. Then there are people who are doing trench repairs, digging out the drainage, because guess what happens to ditches? They fill with water. What do you have to do? You have to drain them. So you put down, you dig drains, you dig sump holes, which people fall into, which is amusing, but never mind. And you put down ductboards. And people, you know, a German shell comes and smashes it up. You have to sort it out. German shell smashes down your parapet. You've got to repair it carefully because they might shoot you while you're doing it. And then at night, there are other tasks, like you have to go out and put barbed wire out. So there's lots of things that they have to do. So in the sense of shifts, no, they're not on and off duty. They're basically all attending to these various things, and then they get to sleep, I suppose, at night. Those that aren't doing the carrying party or anything else.
So another sort of similar but slightly different question from Adrian Smith on Facebook, who has asked, how much time would a regular soldier spend in combat, and how long would they perhaps spend waiting to be attacked or attack themselves?
This is another interesting aspect, because it's not like you think. There's a well-known historian, and that's a man called Gordon Corrigan, and he pointed out that the British Army spent more time playing football than it did going over the top. And now that's obvious, because a football takes an hour and a half, and going over the top doesn't take very long, and doesn't take any time if you're killed. Gordon's point is a serious one. It is that the average soldier would only attack or be attacked a couple of times in the whole of their trench experience. Now, that is not a hard and fast rule. And obviously, it depends how long you're in for. But in your 2 or 3 days in the trenches, you are unlikely to attack and unlikely to be attacked. It's more just occasional losses through shell fire, sniping, that kind of thing. That's what causes the problem there. When they are attacked, though, and there's a play and film called Journey's End, which shows before the big German attack of 1918, it's the most tense and horrible experience there can be. It's unbelievably awful for people to cope with because they know it's coming and they know the Germans will cut them off with shell fire, and that is a nightmare experience.
With that in mind, Jeff Cunningham on Twitter has asked, how did soldiers on the front pass their free time?
Well, the free time they had would normally be at night or in between the sergeant coming around and telling them to do their, go and dig that out, do that, whatever. A lot of them would just spend it drinking tea. They made a fixation, the British Army still does, of hot, sweetened tea. They'd drink that all the time. They'd write letters home. And read letters. That's incredibly important to people. I mean, we don't write letters anymore, but in those days, you never hear from your girlfriend or your parents again. So it was incredibly important. And they'd write home. The letters are staggeringly dull. Hope this finds you as it leaves me. In the pink. It's what 90% of them read. But then there are some that are wonderful authors. And so they do that. They talk. They talk about almost anything but the war. Anything but the war. So they talk about, what would you have to eat? Well, I'd have steak and kidney pie. And they imagine these fantastic meals. But they talk about anything and everything to keep their minds off the topic. And the other thing they do is sleep, because they were tired. It's only 2 or 3 days, but it is a tiring 2 or 3 days and stressful.
You've picked up on so many little bits that I want to ask you about there. So I'm going to start by just a really general question. Can you give us an overview? What was living in the trenches actually like, and how did it change throughout the war?
The actual physical, it just depends. I'm sorry to say. I mean, in 1914, when the first trenches were, they were ditches. They were, in fact, they were often farmers. Do you know the ditches around a farmer's field? Perhaps with a hedge in front of it. And the Germans have got a trench in front, say at the Aisne or somewhere, and they take cover, they get into the ditch, and then they can't get any further forward, so they dig a communication trench back. They connect up the posts. And that's a trench. But it's still primitive. Now, later on, it gets to the stage I described earlier, so I don't need to do that again. But later on in the war, they start to get concrete pillboxes, concrete, reinforced concrete bits. Often they have places they can sleep, underground, awful places that are probably, some of them still exist in the Ypres sector. They're awful. They're terrifying. And so life does change. Some things don't change. I'm sure we're going to come back to things like that, but you can pick up on, if you like, now. Things like food.
But yeah, we've had several questions about this, from what was the soldier's diet like, what do they eat, how do they even cook?
The British Army provides you with a fantastic diet if you don't like food, enjoying food. I mean, funnily enough, I'm not interested in food either, so I don't suppose I'd suffer. But it's basically 4,000 calories. So not good for the figure, but you're burning it up. And it can be brought up as stews and the rest of it, but normally it's tinned. And when I say tinned, I mean tinned food. Some of it, like I'm going to mention a name here, but it's almost generic. Fray Bentos corned beef, then as now. The little tins with the keys on. Soldiers even told me, because I used to be an interviewer for the woman, they told me how they used to be opening the tin and the key always comes off, so they'd use their 18-inch bayonet. I still remember one pointed to a great gash on this thing, said, "Well, how many times I was wounded in 4 years in the war? Bloody tin, blah, blah." But the thing about bully beef is corned beef, which is very salty, not particularly appetizing. It's all right. Not every day, though. It gets very boring. What else do they have with it? Well, that's fantastic. They have, it's almost like dog biscuits. They look like dog biscuits. Extremely nutritious. Good for you. Not good to eat. They had salted bacon in tins which they could fry up, and then they'd use the lard, the fat, those other things. They had something called McConaughey's, which is a sort of lamb and vegetable. And they'd have pork and beans. And they always said they're bloody good at camouflage, that pork, because I've never found any bloody pork in the beans. A little tiny square. Baked beans, haricot beans. They call them haricot beans and baked beans. Those things, again and again and again. And even if you've got hot food, it could well be bully beef stew. Your only way of warming it was with a Tommy cooker, which is it's the same as you get in camping. Little methylated spirit thing with a sort of block that you can burn. Heat just heats something up of it. It's not cooking, it's warming through. And they're pretty unpleasant. McConaughey's especially was unpleasant unless you warmed it through. So I'm told. And so that's what they had to eat. The problem is not that they were hungry. The British soldier does not go hungry. But they get the same. And also, remembering trenches aren't just on the Western Front. So guess what bully beef's like in winter? It's cold. Guess what it's like at Gallipoli in 90 degrees? You pour it out of the can, a mixture of glutinous, horrible, oily, meaty yuck, and with flies buzzing around going, "Ooh, that's nice, I like that." and it's not so good for the soldiers. So it's not that they weren't fed properly. They were. It's the sheer boredom. And you have loads of people saying, "I'll never eat bully beef as long as I live." And they didn't, a lot of them. They just said, no, that. So that's basically what they ate. And it's the repetitiveness of it. And that's why they'd talk, "Oh, I'd love to have a steak and kidney pie. Oh, me, I'd like a lovely omelette." No, you know, whatever. So that's their diet. 4,000 calories, you see, a day. And then, of course, they had to bring up the water. They drank most of their water as tea, but they loved it. And they always said you could stand it. It was so strong with so much sugar, and they used to have condensed milk. And it was an appalling drink. They loved it. Fair dues. So that's what they had to eat. And that's a big part of life in the trenches. It's just waiting for the next meal. Bit of bacon for breakfast, bully beef for dinner, bully beef for tea. Yeah. And what you get for your pudding, not really anything.
What about sleep? Where did people sleep?
Again, it depends when and where. A lot of the time, what time of year. If it's winter, the ordinary soldier would burrow out a little hole, a cubby hole, they called them, in the side of the trench, the side of the Germans, so that a shell didn't come in. And they'd just huddle in there, sat just behind and perhaps two of them to keep warm together, because they had their blanket and waterproof sheet. And that's where a lot of them were. In summer, they'd often sleep on the fire stem, just lying on the fire stem. The officers would have a dugout. If you could dig out, if it didn't flood, that was also a joint headquarters. So that would have a little side room where the officers would sleep, and they'd have a bit of a bed or a homemade bed. The officers had better conditions because they would have a servant there. And they were called servants then. The Second World War term is batman. But the reason they had them is because they're meant to look at the officers are meant to look after the men. The batman or servant looks after the officer. But some officers don't look after the men well enough, and that's when people get a bit mouthy about it. A good officer will look after his men, and that's their priority. That's all that matters to them, and their servant will look after them. But they don't live the life of luxury, and their food is pretty well the same. Later on in the war, moving on again, they had these great underground dugouts, especially in a place like Ypres. And they're just wire beds and I mentioned earlier, terrifying, dank, dark, often captured from the Germans. They were just awful places, awful. Some of them are still there. So that's fundamentally where they slept if they weren't being woken up to go out on a carrying party or woken up to go into no man's land to put wire out or do a patrol or a raid. Or there's so many things that could happen.
We've had another question here about how strongly was the sentiment of lions led by donkeys actually felt on the front?
Not at all, as far as I know. I appreciate certain of the generals, particularly Haig, who was the finest commander-in-chief the British Army ever had. Not necessarily the finest general, I make that clear. And who, under his direction, he didn't invent it, they came up with the all-arms battle, which in the end would win the war. However, a lot of it is people writing in the 1930s. the anti-general thing was, to a large extent, caused by two very prominent politicians. Never make an enemy out of a politician, Emily. And particularly if their names Lloyd George and Winston Churchill, two of the finest politicians we've ever had, brilliant at their job, wrong in every single case of every strategy and tactic they ever wanted to do. And the moment Haig died, they tore into him in their memoirs, and people pick up on it. And then it's a 1930s thing, Lions Led by Donkeys, and no one ever said it. It was another conservative politician, Alan Clark, who invented it to put in a book in the early 1960s. It's not, obviously, some people did hate the generals. They hated them as a sort of generic class. And do you know what? I understand that. I used to hate my high-up bosses, the ones I never met, because they were distant figures who affected my life. And in case of the First World War, they ended your life. So, of course, you didn't like some generals, but you didn't know anything about them or anything about it, in fact. You were just being human and reacting as humans do by just hitting out at people who influence your life and you can't influence theirs. And that's where the origin of it comes. But the generals were generally fairly competent. And although they made mistakes, people forget, and this is just a point I want to quickly make. We often say the generals killed our men. They didn't. They talk about the learning curve. It's not one curve. Because they say, why don't they go faster? Why don't the generals do better, quicker? It's because there's two curves. There's the German curve as well. So if you invent something, say the tanks, and the Germans invent pillboxes, you're sort of going up and down like this. And that's why, you know, something that works tactically on Tuesday doesn't necessarily work on Friday. And that's the point. And the generals had to overcome this. That's why I keep saying, well, it's all changed since 1914. It's all changed since 16. It's all changed since 18. And that's part of that thing. So there wasn't a tremendous objection. There was the usual moaning, and I would never say there wasn't.
So on a similar note, Joe Pearce on Twitter has asked, did those in leadership positions actually do anything perhaps to boost morale?
They tried to. Sometimes they'd organise parades and speak to the men. This was counterproductive. That does cause a lot. Because there's nothing worse. Again, if you use your workplace, if the director general calls you in and gives you a speech about how you're all loving it and sadly you've got to have a 5% pay cut, but you're all happy. It's exactly the same. And the generals would call them in and say, we're going over the top and you'll be delighted to know that the first Worcestershires are over the top first. And the lads would go, oh. More positively, officers generally tried to keep the men busy. There's a long-standing belief that if the British soldier, this is slightly apocryphal, if you don't keep the British soldier busy, they'll get drunk and cause trouble. Now, there is some truth in that. It can be exaggerated, but the best thing to do is to keep them busy. And the way they used to do it has never changed. They still do it. They did it in Iraq and Afghanistan. Sport. Tire them out, give them sport, get the games of football, incredibly competitive, company versus company, battalion versus battalion, regiment versus brigade versus brigade. And they set up these huge things. They'd have sports days. They'd set up that kind of thing. The other thing is, of course, and we've already dealt with it, so I'm only going to say it, they moved them in and out of the line. They made sure they weren't in the line too long so that they'd have rest. And they made sure that they got leave and the letters from home. So there is a whole system to keep the men as happy as they could be in the awful situation of being in a frontline infantry unit that's got to go in the trenches next Tuesday sort of thing.
Holly Dolly Duda on Instagram has asked about postal services. How did they work? How did men send letters and how did they get them?
Postal services were incredibly efficient. They had three systems. One is just a card. I am well. I am, you know, I've been wounded. I have not been wounded. Just a card. And they would send them back just to reassure after, say, an attack. Then they'd have letters that were censored. And they were censored by the officer of the unit, so normally the second lieutenant, who were inevitably incredibly rude about the men. And there's all sorts of stories about that. And it's a very Cyrano de Bergerac for things where people are writing to girlfriends for each other and telling them what a good line is. So that's all going on. But most of the lads are just writing home to mum and dad. Remember how old they are. British soldiers tend to be between 18 and 22. A lot of them aren't married. They haven't got girlfriends. So they're writing to their parents. Letters home. They're unbelievable. And when you go through the archives, the Department of Documents at the War Museum has an amazing collection. And you go through them and you see people writing back. And if they're writing to their mum, they'll say, mum, everything, hope this finds me, everything's fine, everything's great. And there's a great example I once uncovered of a letter he wrote to a mum and to his best mate. And to the mum, he says, I'm out the line, I'm completely safe. To best mate, said, it's murder. We were all nearly killed yesterday and we've got to go on the attack tomorrow. I don't know how I can survive another day. This is the worst experience of my life. And he was killed next day. And that's the thing. Depends who you write to. And letters, I mean, if you write it to your mum or your girlfriend, you don't tell them about, say, if you're in Gallipoli, you don't tell them about dysentery. But when you're writing home to in your diary or doing things like that, you do put what happened. And it was interesting. Oral history brought out how much that wasn't in letters about dysentery and things like that. So the third layer of letters were green envelopes, which were uncensored in your unit. So your officer, they might be censored back home. And if you were caught putting anything about where you were and what you were doing in them, you'd be really for it. But they weren't censored by your second lieutenant. And you might want to write something personal. To the wife or girlfriend in that or whatever. Or you just might not want the officer to read it. The letters would then come, so they'd go out with a postman, each battalion had a postman, and they'd come back in and they'd be handed out. Even in the line, they'd get their posts and they'd go and, as I mentioned, they'd read them right back. Some of them wrote daily throughout the time they were out there. So it's an amazingly efficient postal service. That's a good question. I like that people are thinking about the nitty-gritty of it.
A very similar question from Melissa Darby on Twitter. She's asked, did they receive care packages from home? And how essential were these?
Not really. Some regiments organised things to be sent out, but mostly it's families. And there's one wonderful story of somebody who sent just a parcel. And, and they sent it out to Gallipoli. And I still remember this. I put it in one of my books. And they sent out some socks and some a cake and something. And in the middle of it, before they sent it from England to Gallipoli, which is 2,000 miles away, they'd put a bunch of bananas. And the bloke said that it had sort of turned into some sort of thing from Dante's Inferno, and that even the socks had surrendered to the general dissolution. But the point was, they'd send things out, and more sensible families would send things out that were their cakes, sweets, cigarettes, newspapers from home, that was popular. So they'd get them. But it was normally your family that would do it. And it was tradition that you'd share everything with your mates. There's no squirreling away and eating that big thing of sweeties to yourself. No, or big cake. You shared it and you shared each other's. And that's how it worked.
MHFQ on Instagram has asked, did any inventions come out of life within the trenches?
What happened was a need was felt, and that need was answered by inventions. For one thing is the periscope, obviously, which is just a child's toy, became important for looking and seeing what's over there. And then somebody, for instance, at Gallipoli, the trenches are very close together. So if you stuck your head up to shoot someone, they shot you. So they put a rifle connected to a periscope so that you aimed the periscope and then fired the rifle from below. We needed mortars, which are things that go fire up and go down. They've not got a long range, they go oop and down. So they invented something called a Stokes mortar. Different sorts of hand grenade. Lewis gun, they needed a light machine gun instead of the heavy Vickers machine gun. So they would respond to that kind of need. It's not so much, with the exception of the periscope rifle, they tend not to be invented by somebody in the trench going, oh. They tend to be more, somebody says we need this, and they sort of work it out back home.
Paul Orton on Facebook has asked, what was the biggest cause of injury to soldiers in terms of armaments?
It's not machine guns. It's not bullets, even. You can't tell a machine gun bullet from a rifle bullet. Then together, they caused 39% of casualties. The RAMC did an analysis of casualties. 39% were bullets of various sorts, and then 58% were shells. Now, that's a high-explosive shrapnel, which is bullets projected out of the exploding shell, and gas. It's mainly shrapnel and explosions, and that's 58%. Then 2% were hand grenades, and 0.32 was the rest. I mean, gas within that is very small. Gas was to make you put your gas mask on, and then you can't quite hear properly outside. You've got a thing over your eyes, so you can't see properly, and your breathing's restricted. So when you try and, say, load a gun, big 5.9-inch gun or 18-pounder gun, it's difficult. You run out of breath. You can't hear the orders of command, and it's just you are unable to carry out your functions as a soldier properly. And that's why they put gas down, to render you useless. If you kill you, that's good as well, for their perspective. But that's not what they're trying to do. That's later on in the war when they've all got gas masks. The main killer is artillery, gunfire, and that's relentless. You're only exposed to machine guns if you wander about, in a flippant way of saying, going into an attack, or you're caught and, say, a wiring party or a raid in no man's land, then machine guns will do you. But even then, if a battery of 5.9-inch German guns open up on you, they'll kill you far more certainly than a machine gun.
Gareth Reese Collins on Twitter has asked, okay, when during periods of deadlock, when neither side was advancing or going over the top, how safe or dangerous was daily life in the trenches? What were the main risks?
Depends where you are and what's happening and how close you are to the enemy. It's a good question, though. You're never free of risk from artillery. If some gunner back behind the German lines decides to just adjust the dial a bit more that way, that could be the end of you. So shell fire is constant. And a shell could land in a trench. The trenches, I forgot to mention, are in bays. So separate bays. So that if a shell lands, it only kills those in that bay. But it depends who's in that bay, or perhaps if a high explosive crashes into a dugout that's full of people. That is the main risk. But sniping. Now, sniping is a concealed German or British, but let's take it as a German sniper, who is in a hidden position and waits for you to expose yourself, whether it be looking over the top, or actually, I'm quite tall, I'm 6'4", and people at my height, when they walk, their head goes up and down, and they used to put a bullet through the top of your head. It's horrible to think of. And they'd see you bouncing, and they'd aim to the next point and fire just as your head reached that point. Snipers weren't that popular, or with either side, both on their own side and the other, because it's a cold-blooded business, but it's all part of making war. So they're the and machine guns. If you're looking over the top and a machine gun happens to traverse by, they happen to be firing, then they'll get you. But snipers are sort of more individually deadly. But it's not that many. And if you look at the statistics, if you're in a quiet sector, you're in for 2 days. You might have one casualty and not necessarily dead. If you're in the Ypres sector or the Somme or poor old French, we had lots of rough sectors, then you could be unlucky and you could have 10 or 20 casualties. You could have more. Those are the main risks. And, of course, you could get gassed, which may not kill you, but if you get a whiff of it, then it can give you severe problems with your throat and things that demand you being taken back as a casualty.
Julie Christie, too, on Facebook has asked, is it true that more soldiers died from disease rather than combat?
Now, one thing about people think loads of people die of disease, but actually troops were just as healthy as you might expect. They had a good diet, and funnily enough, that people joke that the outdoor life didn't seem to do them any harm. When they have a real freeze, well, obviously there is a risk of exposure, but very few people die of it. Where they died is in Gallipoli and Mesopotamia, where people died of a horrid cocktail of diseases, based on dysentery, but also including typhus and a thing called soldier's heart, which is basically where you get disordered action of the heart because your body's in such a state and your heart says, stop this for a game of soldiers, literally. And you don't die. But some people do, but not a lot. So the answer is that you get ill, but most people don't die of it unless they're unlucky. And I want to make it quite clear that people did die. People got pneumonia, and of course the great flu epidemic, influenza, which in COVID days has a real echo for us. But thousands of people died of influenza. Of all of the things, influenza was the real killer. For the rest of the time, the soldiers were fundamentally healthy. They were really in good nick. Were they unhappy and cold and wet? Yes. There is one disease that might... Trench foot. You've got a question about trench foot, I think.
Someone's asked, can you explain what it is, what are the causes and effects, and basically just tell us a bit more about trench foot.
I always think it's like when you stay in the bath for too long. When you were young and you stay in the bath, you don't go spongy almost. Except it's not funny. It's having your feet in freezing cold water for hours and hours and hours. And you get a sort of sponginess that goes dead. And then you start to get frostbite. Your toes go black and then they fall off. Trench feet is perfectly stoppable. You can stop it in its tracks, so to speak. It's an unfortunate expression. By change of dry socks, putting dry socks on, putting your feet somewhere not in the water. However, that's impossible, say, in 1914 in the Western Front, where you're in a ditch with no drainage. And if you don't stand in the water, the Germans will put a bullet through your head. It should be above the low trenches. So it's basically just freezing cold water and constant immersion in it. There was a cure that was practical, which is that you rub your feet in whale oil. Now, I often wondered which genius first thought of this whilst thinking about whales. So I'll just rub some whale oil on my feet and see if it stops them from getting trenchy. Whatever. But it does work. And one of the ways that the headquarters could tell if a unit was any good was by the trench, after 1915, was the amount of trench feet. So they've got trench feet, they got poor discipline, they weren't using whale oil. The other disease is pyrexia of unknown origin. And pyrexia means fever. It means you've got a fever, but they don't know what caused it. They now think it was caused by lice, because they're all living on top of each other, so to speak, and they get lice in the clothes. Once you've got the lice and the bites from a lice, they thought give you this fever. But that, again, doesn't kill you. It just makes you poorly. Perhaps we should talk about sanitation, I think.
Very good point to move on to, actually. This is something we've had questions about as well. People asking, were there any methods put in place to keep trenches hygienic is probably the wrong word, but sanitation is probably the right way to go with that.
They tried. They had people, but every battalion would have sanitary personnel. The things they most watch for are, one, latrine discipline. There was a set latrine, which was not nice, often just cross things and a pole between them. That's in Gallipoli a lot, or just almost a bucket arrangement. So that's how they tried, and they tried to drain them. That's the main so they'd use A-boards, they used duck boards, they tried sumps, which people fell in, which I find very amusing when they do fall in. And so they do make an effort, but fundamentally it's quite difficult.
Louis Pelou on Instagram has asked, were there any psychiatric symptoms particularly prevalent in soldiers who fought in the First World War and in particular in the trenches?
The answer is no. We used to call it shell shock. Shell shock doesn't exist. It's a collation of symptoms, which we would now recognise as being post-traumatic stress, PTSD. And this is caused by a variety of things, mainly stress. It's not that people used to think it was a concussive effect of explosions, but mostly it's stress. And it could be anything. Do you know, people would have been, they'd stammer, obviously, you can imagine. But some were struck mute. Some couldn't hear anything. Somehow they lost their sense of hearing. It's their brain. Some became blind. Couldn't see. They're uncontrollable, defecating in public, behaving in a complete drunk, all sorts of symptoms. And it was very real indeed. And it was accepted as so very early on in the war. There were some awful things like officers are more prevalent to it because they're more sensitive. So you get things that you do not recognise as being true. Poets are more sensitive, you know, they're more likely to get shelter. No, it just depends what's happened to you and how stressed you are and how you've been able to respond to it. Because I don't think I couldn't have stood up to any of it. So yes, there are terrible psychiatric symptoms. I've got a book where a bloke reckons he could cure any of them and did cure them at Malta by hypnosis. Because they were in the hospitals until the 1960s, some of them, completely institutionalised. Of course, once you're in for 20 or 30, 20 years or so, you're institutional, you can't live a normal life anyway. So it was a terrible thing. I'm not saying that it was handled well all the time, because it wasn't. But mostly it was understood by doctors, and they tried to get people out, get them rested, and they would try and get them back as well.
Now, I've got two final questions for you, and these are both about public perceptions of life in the trenches. So first off, Naomi Warwick on Facebook has asked, what is the biggest myth surrounding life in the trenches?
Well, the biggest myth is definitely about generals being incompetent, about them being chateau generals and back out of the line. It is not true. The generals were back at, they were at chateaus of big buildings because they had a big staff. They were there because that's the nodal point of communications. And that's where, if you're in the front line, you can't control anything. However, just to put this in context, there were four lieutenant generals commanding a corps, which is something like 60,000 men, 12 major generals, that's commanding a division, that's 12 to 18,000 men, and 81 brigadier generals, that's 3 to 4,000 men, were killed. Not wounded. There was another 146 wounded or prisoners of war. Now, the myth, it's not just about Haig, it's that all generals are sort of incompetent buffoons. But I'd like to make another point. I want you to think about this. Those generals, I mean, I'm old now, I'm 68. Those generals weren't anywhere near as old as I am. They're in their 50s. A lot of the brigadiers are in their 40s or even younger. The youngest was about 22. The ones that were, say, people like Haig or Rawlinson or Robertson, do you know what? They weren't always old. And funnily enough, if you might put this on the word, hey, Douglas Haig, as a young 22-year-old, was drop-dead gorgeous. He looked gorgeous. Do you see what I mean? He was a young second lieutenant, then he was a captain. He was involved in a cavalry charge at Omdurman. He was nearly cut off by the other side. And then he fought his way through the Boer War, where the Boers will certainly kill you as soon as they look at you. And this is the same for all the generals. They just happen to... They're frozen in time in some people's mind. Frozen in time as old buffers, General Melchett, whatever. But they weren't always like that. They've got a lifetime of experience, and they personally not only risked their lives in the First World War, but had risked their lives in the Sudanese or Boer War or any of those other Indian campaigns that could be terrible if you were on the wrong end of it.
I think this perfectly brings us on to our last question, which is from Guy Avney on Facebook. So, putting jokes aside, how accurate were the trenches and bunkers in Blackadder Goes Forth?
Well, I love Blackadder, but that because it's a fantastic TV show. It's funny. I think the trenches look and the dugout looks reasonably accurate, and it's an officer's dugout. That's not where the men are. I think that's a reasonable representation. The trenches are it's roughly in proportion. They've had some good advice. Where it's wrong is that they're there all the time. And that's part of that myth. They're there all the time. So they're always in their dugout. They're always there. That would not be the case. They'd be in there for 2 or 3 days and then out. And the view, we've already covered the general. Melchett would be a particularly bad general. that's not fair representation. But Blackadder was wonderful. And, you know, I always like to think that their view of Blackadder's view of the Royal Flying Corps has an element of truth when, you know, the 50 minutes or whatever it is, and, you know, Lord Flashard and all the rest of it. But you can imagine what a young second lieutenant or a sergeant in the trenches thought as he looked up and saw them flying about above them. So some of it has truth in it there. But the other thing is, it's not all true. Do we think Game of Thrones is some sort of truth? It isn't. And Blackadder is just fabulous comedy. Just enjoy it as a comedy and enjoy the jokes.
That was Peter Hart. Peter is a historian and the author of military history books surrounding the First and Second World Wars. And he's also worked as an oral historian at the Imperial War Museum.
Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.
Before you go, one final word about this week's sponsor, Warner Hotels. If you fancy a break in 2024, you can now choose from 3 fantastic weekend packages at some of the most historic Warner hotels. For instance, Little Coat House is set in a stunning location in Hungerford, which has played host to Romans, a Civil War army, and the planning of the D-Day landings. Meanwhile, Studley Castle in Warwickshire was used as a training camp for the Women's Land Army during the World Wars. Find out more and book your break now at warnerhotels.co.uk.